Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back my guest co-host, Dr. Bob Gwyther, while Dr. Christy Page is on vacation. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks, Adam. It's great to be here.
You know, on our show today, we've got a really interesting interview with Dr. Joshua Thaden, fellow in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Duke University School of Medicine, about resistant and hospital-acquired infections. This is kind of like the bane of microbiology for a primary care doctor. Oy, I'm looking forward to getting some help.
Yeah, and you know, we've picked a couple of articles here that actually are on that theme, so we can use it in both of these.
Yeah, we're talking about antibiotic resistance and routine surgeries, about kind of healthcare practices that are low value, but are they still being done? What else we can talk about, Bob?
Blood pressure treatment and whether it really has a good effect on long-term outcomes of cardiovascular disease.
And then finally, about treating sepsis or really severe infection. If you treat it early, can you really make a difference? Stay tuned, because we're going to tell you in just a second. Let's talk about this first article, Bob. Antibiotic resistance in routine surgery. Huh. What's that about?
Well, this study was published in the Journal of Lancet Infectious Disease just recently. And essentially, what they're trying to say is that there's a lot of antibiotics that we use in certain particular surgeries, like hip replacements and cesarean sections, that for years have been used because it improves the outcomes of the surgery. And the question is, are those going to work if the bacteria that are affected with are antibiotic resistant? And the answer is, if they are resistant and they don't work, then we're looking at a lot of complications and a lot of expense.
Well, and it turns out that increasingly the infections that do occur after these types of surgeries are due to resistant bacteria, which probably isn't surprising, because if you give antibiotics, it may prevent the bacteria that you expect, but then the ones that are around are going to be more resistant. And they estimated that if the drugs that are being used to prevent infections become resistant just 30% of the time, that would be 120,000 more infections and 6,300 more infection-related deaths. Whoa, ding, ding.
That is
That's
scary.
A big problem. And, you know, I know I'm not going to probably get my C-section, but prostate infections are one thing that me and other men would have. And so these are just, again, things that we really need to be aware of. And I guess part of the question is, what are we going to do about it? And this is where we need more research, but it's not just coming up with better drugs.
Well, we're going to start by interviewing somebody in the next segment of this program who is going to try to answer that question precisely. So hold
we'll
the
look
phone.
Forward to that, and we'll pass the buck, but we know that it's a problem, and we all need to be doing better, probably patients and doctors. Our next Research That Matter, Bob's, is something that's probably near and dear to you, who has practiced for a good while and seen a lot of things maybe be used over the time that may not help patients.
We've practiced medicine for quite a long time now with a lot of scientific capabilities of things that we can do to patients. The question is it worth the money we spend, the time the patients invest in it, and should we be doing those things at all?
And this was in the research that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty journal, Internal Medicine. And it was looking at the evaluation of an effort that started in 2009 called Choosing Wisely campaign that tried to reduce kind of the waste in our system by trying to cut down on seven things that they say really shouldn't be done. Like if you have just an uncomplicated headache, you don't get a CAT scan of your head. If you come in for a preoperative surgery evaluation, you don't get a chest X-ray. If you have a woman younger than age 30, you don't have to be tested for the human papillomavirus, things like that.
Yeah. And so the researchers, it's Abby Agrio, I believe, of Health Corps in Wilmington, actually went back and looked at a lot of Blue Cross Anthem patients. And they looked at – it's a big $25 million member organization. They looked at the last – so it's 2009, so 3 or 4 years, to see if there's been any downward trend in the utilization of those things that we don't consider very cost effective.
And some things they found improvement. The use of imaging for headache fell from, you know, almost 15% to a little over 13%. Heart imaging decreased some, and antibiotics for sinusitis dropped. But I was like, really? Just from 84.5% to 83.7%? At that rate, Bob, it'll be about, another 50 years before we get that down to a level that most of us would say that's acceptable.
And if you got 25 million people, you're looking at a statistically significant drop. But practically, is it saving very much money?
These preoperative chest x-rays, the treatments for low back pain where they do, again, CAT scans, and prescription non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents actually rose. So, wow, it seems like we need something better here. And one of the things I would just suggest is ask your doctor – any of us, do I really need this test, whatever the test is?
And the question always for me is why those doctors continue to do it. And maybe they haven't seen the new guidelines. I mean, that may be as simple as answer as that. Or maybe we're all just stuck in our practice patterns and we're so used to doing things it's hard to make changes.
You know, maybe sometimes patients come in and ask us for certain things. But both our colleagues and our patients, we need to do better. There's a common theme here. Well, talking about doing better, this is an interesting, our next research that matters about blood pressure medications and reducing kind of the things like strokes and kidney damage. Does earlier treatment make a difference?
And so they did a very nice study at Northwestern, and they published it in the Journal of American Heart Association, basically looking at people who've been blood pressure treatment, and to see if the treatment actually makes a difference in their outcomes, particularly cardiovascular outcomes like strokes and heart attacks.
And they had nearly 9,000 folks, and it was called the MESA study, Multi-Ethnic Study of Atherosclerosis. That's one of my favorite names of a study in a long time, Bob. And they also had the Coronary Artery Risk Development in Young Adults, CARDIA study, good names for both of them. And they found that those who were treated with these, all of them were 50 years or older at baseline. Even if they were well controlled, they still had a much higher risk of heart disease in the next 10 years compared to those who had had good control of their blood pressure but had never really been on treatment, and they weren't hypertensive, meaning, boy, these folks perhaps had damage before they even got on the treatment.
So it's interesting. You would almost predict this. The people who had normal blood pressure and didn't need treatment did the best. The people who got treated for hypertension and got their blood pressures down to good control levels did the intermediate. And the people who either didn't get take their medications or were untreated and had high blood pressure did the worst.
Yeah. Well, again, getting the blood pressure treated early rather than saying, let's just wait a couple years, may well be indicated for a lot of people to lower their risk. Last thing about lowering risk is our last research that matters, Bob, was a study that was in the American Journal of Medical Quality about a deadly infection called a complication of an infection called sepsis, where people's blood pressure bottoms out, a lot of their blood vessels become leaky, they get really sick, and they die quickly.
So this is interesting because it uses some new age technology up in the cloud to try to do surveillance on a lot of patients and have a system set up in the hospital such that if the cloud algorithm shows that somebody's developing sepsis or at least signs of sepsis, they immediately call the nurse in charge of the patient, who immediately gets the doctor on the phone, gets him or her up to assess this patient and start antibiotics early if possible.
And this is a situation where early antibiotic usage actually can save a tremendous amount of lives. And it's just a lot of this is based on if you come in the hospital and your heart and your breathing rates are really abnormal, it can trigger an alarm, and particularly with the blood pressure. And in this particular study, because they were so quick with this cloud to institute treatments, it resulted in a 30% reduction of really bad outcomes of sepsis, such as death or going to a nursing home. Big study, important study. I know we're revising all of our protocols for quickly treating sepsis. This is a good thing. It helps patients.
But it did show that if you were already in the ICU, you didn't do as well if somebody picked this up as if it got picked up when you were still in the emergency room and the aggressive antibiotic therapy got started earlier.
Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Joshua Thaden, fellow in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Duke University School of Medicine, about resistant and hospital-acquired infections and the types of things that we've just been talking about. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Gwyther. Today on Conversations, Bob, we're talking with Dr. Joshua Thaden, fellow in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Duke University School of Medicine, about resistant and hospital-acquired infections, a really critically important issue.
Welcome, Dr. Thaden. Thank you for being with us today.
Hey, Edmund, Bob. Thanks so much for having me.
You know, Dr. Thaden, you work in infectious diseases, and that gives you kind of a unique perspective on infections because you live it day and night. How did you get interested in this particular field of medicine? Did you wake up one day as a first-year medical student and say, I want to deal with infections?
Well, that's a great question. Well, I'll tell you, I have had an interest in infections for a long time. I think there's two big things. One is just an intellectual interest. I studied biology in college, and then later I did a PhD where I was in the lab studying really basic science, the molecular biology of some drug-resistant infections. And I still have a lot of curiosity about how it is that these infections develop, how do they get resistant, and how do we treat them better. And the second thing is that I just think it's a really important issue in terms of human health. You know, in the world, infectious diseases are one of the leading causes of death. And in the U.S. in particular, and in other places, one of the big infectious disease issues that we're dealing with is antibiotic resistance. And bacteria are just getting more and more difficult to treat due to a lack of effective antibiotic options. And so it's an area that I think needs a lot of attention, and this led me to the field as well.
So, Dr. Thaden, you and your colleagues at Duke just published a study on resistant E. coli infections in community hospitals. This gets at quite a few issues in medicine, but could you start us off with what, in general, you found in this study?
Sure. So in our study, we examined a particularly antibiotic-resistant form of E. coli called ESBL-producing E. coli. And this E. coli has an enzyme that degrades antibiotics. And it can cause many different types of infections, but probably the most common type of infection is urinary tract infection, or UTIs. And so we've seen increases in these antibiotic-resistant infections at big medical centers like UNC Medical Center and here at Duke University Medical Center, but we didn't know if these infections were present in smaller community hospitals as well. And in fact, we thought probably they weren't. We thought that probably this is an issue mainly at these bigger medical centers. But it's an important question, as the great majority of Americans get their care at these smaller community hospitals as opposed to bigger places like UNC and at Duke. So we analyzed a set of 26 hospitals in the Duke Infection Control Outreach Network, and these 26 hospitals were scattered throughout the southeastern U.S. They were in North Carolina, South Carolina, Virginia, and Georgia. And what we found is that infections with these ESBL E. coli, these highly drug-resistant infections, increased significantly, in fact, doubled over the 5-year study period. And interestingly, some of these E. coli infections were even increasing in patients without significant healthcare exposure, and we call these infections community-associated infections. And so it was pretty surprising, first, that these infections were present and increasing to such a high degree, and second, that there were so many community-associated infections.
You know, when I went to medical school, Dr. Thaden, in the 1800s, I one of the things that we, you know, it was so great to learn microbiology and to think about E. coli because it was such an easy thing to treat. You put them on a sulfa medication or anything else, and it was like, oh, it's going to be easy. And it seemed like somewhere along the line that changed, and you began to see these resistant E. coli. And then all of a sudden in the last couple of years, you hear about all these really, really bad E. coli, which are different. Explain the difference between what people talk about, that hemorrhagic E. coli that people are getting killed across the country, and this resistant. Are they related or are they completely different?
So they're a little bit different. So the hemorrhagic E. coli or enterohemorrhagic E. coli is
the bloody kind. Bloody diarrhea.
Exactly right. And it has kind of some specific toxins and genes that really make it especially hard on the colon. And so they cause a lot of bloody diarrhea and can really be bad, associated with really poor patient outcomes. And so in cases like that, those E. coli are bad because they just are really hard on the body, really. And so that's one thing. Now, the study that we did, for example, doesn't necessarily involve that type of E. coli. It's sort of the non-hemorrhagic E. coli, but they're also tough to deal with, not necessarily because they have all these genes that cause bloody diarrhea, but because they're antibiotic resistant. And so, you know, it is technically possible to have a E. coli that's both hemorrhagic, as you mentioned, and antibiotic resistant. But generally speaking, they're sort of two different things.
You know, it's kind of a delicate balance between using antibiotics. We need to make surgery safe and treat illnesses, and the other side of the coin is creating resistant infections. How can both our listeners and medical professionals use antimicrobial drugs responsibly to prevent new strains of resistant organisms?
That's a great question, Bob. You know, from the patient's perspective, the big thing to know is that antibiotics treat bacterial infections and not viral infections. But unfortunately, many of the common infections that we see, such as sinusitis, sore throat, bronchitis, diarrheal illnesses, others, are much more commonly caused by viruses rather than bacteria. You know, so in these cases, taking antibiotics not only is not going to help the infection, but the antibiotics can actually be harmful in that, A, it increases your risk of future antibiotic-resistant infections, and B, it can result in some medication side effects, such as kidney injury or liver damage. So the bottom line is that antibiotics should only be taken as prescribed. You know, for example, it's not a good idea to take leftover antibiotics from a prior prescription or take your friend's antibiotics or something like that. And, you know, from the healthcare provider's perspective, we need to make sure that we're only prescribing antibiotics in the appropriate situations. And there are good resources online, such as the CDC website, IDSA website, and others that discuss good antibiotic prescribing practices. But I have to tell you, it's really difficult when patients come in with a viral infection, for example, because we want to do something. You know, and a patient may or may not have the may not be looking for antibiotics or want antibiotics, but from the provider's perspective, we really want to do something to help. But we need to understand that there are real negative consequences to inappropriate antibiotic use, and so we should try and resist the temptation to prescribe antibiotics when they're not really needed.
I know that a lot of farmers, particularly ones growing cattle and producing milk, will give their animals antibiotics in order to keep infections away, theoretically. Does that influence the human use of this?
I tell you, it absolutely is going to influence antibiotic resistance for sure. It's a big issue. You know, in total, much more antibiotics are given to livestock than to humans. You know, those antibiotics, and as well as the antibiotic-resistant organisms that develop, end up making their way to meat and then into our bodies. And so it's a big issue. And so antibiotics being given to cattle, for example, or pigs, is definitely increasing the number of antibiotic-resistant bacteria that we're seeing, without a doubt. And, you know, the FDA has implemented some new policies, one back in 2013, for example, to try and do something about that. What they're trying to do is sort of restrict to some degree the degree of antibiotics that are being prescribed by veterinarians. And so it's kind of too early to say whether or not that's having an effect, but it's something that we're definitely thinking about, and it's a big issue for sure.
So we're going to need to take a short break, but one really quick question. We know about the docs out there who perhaps could be doing a better job with their prescribing. What about patients? Are there patient factors that maybe increase resistance? And the one I think about are, you know, you start taking an antibiotic and 2 or 3 days later you feel better, and the doctor wanted you to take it for 5 to 7 days. Is that a factor or not?
You know, it is. Because, you know, one thing we want to make sure of, for example, is that when we're treating a bacterial infection, that it's completely treated. You know, the problem is that if you just take the antibiotics for a couple of days, you've let a few of those bacteria stick around. And in fact, by using the antibiotic, you're actually exerting a selective pressure. So there's a good chance that the few bacteria that have not been killed because you didn't complete the antibiotic course are resistant to the antibiotic. So you're absolutely right. It's very important to complete the entire course of antibiotics and not stop just because you're feeling better.
Well, we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Joshua Thaden, fellow in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Duke University, about resistant and hospital-acquired infections. You'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Whitehead.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Bob Whitehead. We've been talking with Dr. Joshua Thaden, fellow in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Duke University School of Medicine, about resistant and hospital-acquired infections. And Dr. Thaden, help us understand, how does this actually play out for a patient and their family? Take us through a case.
Sure. So I had a patient, for example, that I saw in clinic who came in with typical symptoms of a urinary tract infection. And so, you know, we started by just prescribing a normal, even before we prescribed antibiotics, we got a urine test. We got a urine culture, although the results of that urine culture, of course, took about 2 or 3 days to come back. But we just started the patient on an antibiotic by mouth. And so she went home. Unfortunately, she didn't get any better, and in fact, just got worse and started having fevers. And what the urine culture showed is that she had one of these drug-resistant bacteria. And one of the real problems with these infections is that we can't even treat them with any antibiotics by mouth. You know, the only way to treat them is by antibiotics by IV. And so we had it was quite a complicated affair, actually. We had to bring her back into the hospital, and we had to put an IV line in her called a PICC line, which can be used to treat folks with antibiotics at home for a long period of time. And we had to give her antibiotics for about 2 weeks because she had just been getting worse and worse with this infection. And, you know, this story has a happy ending because we were able to treat her infection appropriately. But, you know, there were a lot of complications with it. You know, first she had to have home health care as well as this line, and so it ended up costing her a lot of money to get this thing taken care of. And she was lucky in that she didn't have any complications with her PICC line, but all too often we see complications with the lines. Maybe a patient gets bleeding, or maybe they even get a whole nother infection because they have a line in. So it's really a complicated and often quite expensive way to deal with these infections.
This is a line that goes into their arm going up towards the heart.
Exactly right. You're exactly right. So it starts at the arm, and it's kind of this long catheter that extends all the way up into the superior vena cava right as it enters the heart. You're absolutely right. And, you know, the tough thing, too, is that in general, the outcomes, patient outcomes with these infections are much worse than with non-resistant infections. In some cases, mortality, for example, can be as high as 20% to 30% with this type of infection, ESBL infection, in most studies. And like I said, luckily this patient we caught it early within a couple of days, and she did well. But it's a pretty scary scenario.
One of the things you found in your article was that patient's skin can be a place where E. coli is carried, and if that's the situation, the patient might be bringing it into the clinic and not showing any symptoms at all. What can clinics do to look for those patients with resistant strains?
So that's a great question. It's a difficult one to answer. It can be really difficult to detect colonization, and there are no perfect tests for that, especially in a clinic setting where even if we took a skin swab, for example, it would take hours for that to come back. So it's a difficult issue to deal with in the clinic setting. Certainly one thing that could be done is simply ask patients if they've ever had a drug-resistant infection. And if the answer is yes, then certain things can be done, like using gloves when taking vitals or doing the physical exam or being sure to clean your stethoscope, et cetera, in order to prevent transmission to other patients. But obviously that's not a perfect method, and some are going to slip through the cracks there. And unfortunately, we don't have great ways to pick up colonization in the clinic setting.
I know as primary care people, we're constantly aware of the increasing cost of healthcare, and I can't imagine doing skin cultures for E. coli for people as a cost-effective way. You could buy a year's supply of soap just for the cost of one test. So, I mean, do you ever recommend to people that, you know, just regular old hygiene can help too?
Absolutely. And that's, you know, sometimes the simplest methods are the best. And I think, you know, regular oral hygiene, like you mentioned, in particular hand hygiene, is a great way to prevent just infections generally and antibiotic-resistant infections in particular. I think we don't do a good enough job washing our hands. We should be doing it a lot more frequently. You know, certainly, for example, before we eat or before we treat a cut, care for a person that's sick, or after we use the bathroom, handle uncooked foods, change a diaper, play with a pet, take out the trash, blow our nose, care for someone that's sick. We should be washing our hands with soap and water for 15, 20 seconds just to make sure that we've killed all the bacteria on our hands. It's because you're absolutely right. It's a simple, a cheap, and effective way to prevent infection.
So yeah. Let's pretend I'm a patient in the hospital where we also see a lot of this resistant bacteria, and I want to decrease the chances that I'm going to get it. What are three or four things as an infectious disease expert consultant that you would advise me that I can do to try to decrease the chances that I'm going to develop it? And then I'm the doctor taking care of that patient. What are three or four things or a couple things that you might recommend to me and my team that we can also do? So different perspectives.
Yeah, sure. So from the patient perspective, you know, again, I think so number one would still be hand hygiene. You know, in general, I think we do a good job of cleaning surfaces in hospital rooms, for example, between patients. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that there's a lot of antibiotic-resistant bacteria in hospitals. So even if you're a patient in the hospital and you're walking the halls or something like that, or you're in your room, make sure you're washing your hands pretty frequently.
And would you have your family members, when they come to visit you, ask them to do it as a patient?
I think that's a great suggestion. Absolutely, they should do the same, because the danger is that your family members can pick up an infection in the hospital or even become colonized in the hospital and bring that home with them, in which case the patient's going to be again at risk of being exposed to such an infection. So absolutely. So I would say a good hygiene from both the patients and from their family members. And then secondly, you know, probably try it to some degree at least to limit patient-to-patient contact. Or if you are in contact with other patients, again, make sure you're using good hygiene afterwards, because unfortunately these hospitals are just kind of breeding grounds for real antibiotic-resistant infections. And so anytime you come into contact with another patient, it's best to wash the hands. And then finally, probably just to, again, make sure that you're using your antibiotics appropriately. And in the hospital, of course, it's a little more monitored setting. But you know, anytime you use antibiotics, you're putting yourself at risk for drug-resistant infections in the future. So just, you know, always kind of make sure you're talking with your physicians to make sure that you absolutely need antibiotics. And if you don't, it's best just to not take them.
You know, I used to practice a lot of outpatient family medicine, and there was patients that get these recurrent urinary tract infections for whatever reason. And one bedtime Sceptra pill used to seem to help some people from getting those. And it violates what you're talking about, trying to use a minimal amount of antibiotics. But I wonder what you think about that.
See, You know, that's a good question. We tend not to favor it, and for the reason you mentioned, in that it does, it's really, in one sense, it does help in that you can reduce some infections that way. But the problem is that eventually the bacteria you are going to get resistant to it. And so ultimately you're going to end up, again, probably with urinary tract infections that are recurrent, but then they're more resistant. What we generally favor is one where we suppose a patient has urinary tract infections. I see several patients such as this who, gosh, probably get these infections monthly. And with folks like this, you know, they've been through it so often, they know exactly what a urinary tract infection feels like. I'll often prescribe some antibiotics that they can even have at home. And again, I don't do this for everybody, but in those select circumstances, just so as soon as this infection develops, they can start taking them at home and really kind of knock that out quickly before it gets too bad. Because it does at least limit antibiotic exposure somewhat. You know, they're only taking a couple days per month rather than every day. Because you're right, taking the antibiotic every day is definitely going to promote resistance for sure.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Joshua Thaden, fellow in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Duke University School of Medicine, about resistant and hospital-acquired infections. And I think if there's one take-home message that I'm hearing from you loud and clear, it's don't take antibiotics if you don't need it, and let's try to limit the resistant bacteria.
Absolutely.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being our guest today and sharing your expertise with Your Health listeners.
Thanks so much, Adam and Bob. It was great talking to you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Wilson, Dr. Bob Quaither. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Bob, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about listeners' health questions and concerns. And if a listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send their comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Daniel Lane, to read us our very first House Call question about a particularly unusual eye finding or an eye symptom.
Last month, I attended a conference that was held in a large ballroom, which was kept dark much of the time during PowerPoint presentations. I noticed that when I quickly moved my eyes to the left, I had arc-shaped bright flashes of light in my right eye. When I left the auditorium, I did not have these symptoms. I have not seen the flashes since I got home. Should I do something about this?
Well, yeah, I think you probably ought to get an ophthalmologist to check you out on that one. I'll tell you what I think is going on, which is a relatively benign process. And that one is that as all of us age and get up into our 50s and 60s, our vitreous humor, that's the big grape consistency stuff that fills up most of the eyeball, which is plastered up against the retina, starts to disassociate itself from the retina. And
that doesn't sound pleasant, Bob.
But it's asymptomatic and it's a normal process. And it leads to two things. One of them is an increased change in what's called floaters, and the other one is you can have it tug on your retina a little bit, which is likely what's causing this arc-shaped phenomenon. The real bad thing is if it tears the retina in the process, and that typically has a visual defect, although not always. And if that happens, you want to get seen right away. So I guess I'd get checked out to be sure that your retina looks okay, but I think that's going to be the benign phenomenon.
Yeah, most people have heard of these eye floaters, which are kind of annoying, but they don't really interfere with the sight. And it's these little moving spots that as you're looking at something, especially if you look at something kind of bright, like up at the sky, and you know, kind of see it, you notice it, and you know, then it kind of goes away, and sometimes you see those squiggly lines. I see squiggly lines. I call them moving worms. But they don't last, and they go away, and most people get kind of used to it. And there are little flecks of protein and collagen in this vitreous that kind of cause these problems. And it's just – it is normal, and it happens a lot. But I agree with you, Bob. It seems reasonable to at least go to your primary care physician, possibly an ophthalmologist, optometrist, to have it looked into.
Right.
Daniel, what's our very next house call?
Last month, I took my 13-year-old son on a 4-day hiking trip on the Appalachian Trail. The pack I was carrying weighed about 50 pounds. On the third day of the trip, both of my feet began to hurt, especially in the long bones. It was worse the next day, so on the way home, we stopped at an urgent care center and they took x-rays of both feet. They did not find any fractures, but said that if it did not resolve in a week or two, I should ask my doctor to get MRIs made of my feet. Why is that?
Well, this is a unique phenomenon called stress fractures that this urgent care doctor was concerned about. What can happen is you can have micro fractures in the long bones of your feet. From
ones that you really can't see that easily on an x-ray.
On a plain x-ray. And this guy didn't have a fancy MRI machine, or you can see these in several kinds of imaging. But sometimes they take 2 weeks to show up. And so what he's basically saying is if this doesn't go away, we haven't ruled out the possibility of stress fractures. Because if somebody is not used to walking, 10 miles on the Appalachian Trail up and down hills, and they suddenly take their child out with a 50-pound on their back, they are overdoing probably what they normally would do.
Well, and first of all, we also want to say kudos for going out on that hiking trail and doing something rigorous there. But anything that's too rigorous can have some drawbacks. And you see these stress fractures a lot of times in people who are, you know, high-impact athletes, tennis, track, basketball, tense running and movement and sometimes pushing yourself to the limit, which you may have done. The good news is it almost always gets better with just conservative treatment. I don't like the term stress fracture. It suggests that we're under just a little too much stress. But in this case, it is what happens.
Yeah, you're stressing the bone in that case.
Yeah. Daniel, what's our very last house call?
Lately, I have been getting food stuck in my esophagus if I don't drink liquids after I swallow. This seems to happen most when I eat chicken, especially if I haven't chewed it thoroughly. On two occasions, some chicken got stuck firmly, saliva built up in my esophagus, and I had to vomit to get rid of it. What should I do about this?
Well, Bob, I know there's the Chick-fil-A commercials about eat more chicken. This one should be really chew more chicken because you really do need to chew your food. But it suggests that there could be some things going on here. This is not just, in my opinion, about chewing the food more thoroughly, though that's important. There could be some problems with the food actually getting stuck.
Right. And, you know, you're trying to get things to transit your esophagus from your throat where you swallow down to your stomach. And if something is blocking the way, it can lead to this phenomenon where food gets built up. And the common things that happen are what's called little hiatus hernia, where part of your stomach is up in your chest. And there's a thing called the Schatzky's ring, which means that part of your the place where your esophagus joins your stomach is drifted up into your chest, and it can go squeeze and cause this to happen. But so can esophageal cancer and some other not-so-fun things. So it's also something worth getting checked out, I think.
Yeah, this is one of those things where you'll probably end up needing, if it doesn't get better and you see your doctor, have what's called an EGD, where they actually just look on down into the stomach, and they can fix it right then and there. Pretty safe. But, you know, you don't want to do it if you have to. Well,
right.
That'll conclude the house calls today. And we want to thank everyone for joining us. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you. You can send us your own questions and stories at yourhealth@unc.edu. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship. Our guest today, Dr. Joshua Thaden. And I personally would like to thank Dr. Bob Gwyther, who it's always a pleasure to be with and is a great co-host.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Bob Gwyther. We look forward to seeing you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.